This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Ni los cristianos que los musulmanes. Un creyente merece el mismo respeto que un ateo.
No valen más las personas por el cargo que ostentan. Presidentes y presididos. Representantes y representantes.
And with that, it is exactly midnight here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, which means that with any luck at all, it's time for this. Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there. Well, that sounded positively awful, but maybe this will sound better.
Ya me gritaron mil veces que me regrese a mi tierra, porque aquí no quepo yo. El hombre la dividió. Ellos pintaron la raya para que yo la brincara y me llaman invasor. Es un error bien marcado. Nos quitaron 8 estados. ¿Quién es aquí el invasor?
All right, opening up with the Tigres del Norte, Mexico's finest, with their anthem of the undocumented, Somos Más Americanos. We are more American than you, son of the Anglo-Saxon. They sing on their, I believe, latest album. Is it their latest album? One of their newer albums, Uniendo Fronteras. And tonight we're going to be speaking with two people who have written a book on this theme, Jane Guskin and David Wilson, authors of The Politics of Immigration. Welcome aboard, guys.
Good evening.
Hello.
And, you know, I think I left your book at home.
Well,
foolish me.
Here, take this copy.
Thanks. There we go. So now I had my own copy all marked up and everything. So The Politics of Immigration, Questions and Answers by Jane Guskin and David Wilson. Hot off the press in question being Monthly Review Press. And you guys have been on tour promoting it, but in a somewhat unorthodox manner. You're not actually doing the usual book promotion thing, but you're doing what you call dialogues. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. When the book was first coming out and we were talking about what kind of events we wanted to do, we realized that, I mean, really, that the whole one of the main purposes of the book, we feel, is to get dialogue going among people with different opinions on the subject of immigration and with questions, and really get those questions aired, you know, come up with, there's all kinds of different answers. It's not so cut and dried. I mean, there's a lot of questions and answers. Obviously, that's what the book consists of. But there's a lot of concerns that people have, and sometimes the questions have multiple answers. And we really just wanted people to have a chance to talk about this stuff, because we don't feel like it's really, I mean, I feel like the book is a helpful tool, but it's not enough to just have the book out there. We really want people to engage in dialogue, talk about their own experiences, have people share their own experiences, share, learn from other people's experiences, and just have a real exchange of ideas and information, and have it be a learning experience for everyone involved, including us. So that's the kind of thing that we've been doing, and we just usually start by getting a bunch of questions from the people in the room, and then we work from that, and we sort of find out what answers people have in the room, and, you know, contribute our, you know, the information that we have, and we go from there. So it's been very interesting. I've certainly learned a lot.
And where have you been thus far?
Well, we've done a bunch in New York. We did one up in Rockland County. We did one in Westchester. I went to the Midwest. I did some in Madison, Chicago, St. Louis, Bloomington, Indiana. David went out to Northern California and did one in Berkeley.
You've been to Southern California.
I went to San Diego,
right?
I did four events in San Diego County. Three of them were in the northern part of San Diego County, which is where the immigration issue is really kind of being flogged to death out there, and it's sort of a place where the Minutemen are a really big deal, and so there's a lot of activists who are really feel somewhat overwhelmed at times by the kind of right-wing anti-immigrant rhetoric that they're being bombarded with. So I think it was really helpful for them to, you know, get a fresh perspective, and it was certainly interesting for me sharing thoughts with people who are just sort of confronted with the issue in a very different way than we are here in New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how many gigs did you do in Southern California?
I did four, all of them in San Diego County.
Uh-huh.
And like I said, three of them were in North, what they call North County. It's the northern part of San Diego County.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's the most conservative. San Diego itself, San Diego County itself, is the most conservative county in California, and one of the most conservative in the country.
Most conservative in California.
Mm-hmm. This is what I was been told by people who live there.
Certainly up there.
That's what I was told by people who...
Orange,
I mean,
et cetera,
it's a big, Actually, Orange and Riverside counties have really changed demographically a lot. So is San Diego County, but it's got the Navy there also in San Diego. There's like three or four different naval bases,
right.
So there's a lot of ex-military people, and there's a lot of...
So this is what I've been really curious about as you've been doing this, is what kind of people are showing up at your gigs, particularly in these rather, contested locales like San Diego County?
Well, I have to say mostly it's been people who are progressive, and they may have some concerns about immigration, but they really, they're for immigrant rights for the most part. I would say, the vast majority. We haven't had anybody who's been extremely, we haven't had any Minutemen-style people show up to these events. I think...
Or even people who are sort of on the fence, or maybe they know some Minuteman-type people.
There may be people who are on the fence who stay somewhat quiet. And then there's certain, there's certain questions that come up a lot. Like, a lot of people really are concerned about how... the sort of lowest tier of U.S.-born workers are affected by immigration. So that's a question that comes up a lot, but it's more from a perspective of people really wanting to know how to answer this, not so much people who are angry about it. We really haven't had people who are angry about immigrants.
Or even sort of like conflicted on the question.
Yeah, definitely some people who are conflicted, there's definitely people who are conflicted. Usually they're conflicted on one or two key points. They're not usually sort of conflicted across the board, so they'll say, well, I think this and that is fine, immigrants are great and that's all great, but, if we opened the borders, then it would be chaos, Well, what about, African-American workers, or whatever. They have
and these are all the questions which you address in your book, in fact. And I would definitely like to mix it up with you guys about that. And maybe if we're feeling really adventurous, take some listener phone calls on these questions as well and do an on-air dialogue. But
that would be great. Love to take some calls.
Have you listened to this show before?
No. I'll go anywhere and... dialogue with anyone.
All right. Well, then maybe in about an hour, we'll consider doing that. In the last, half hour, 25 minutes of the show, we'll consider doing that. David, you were also in California, just in the Bay Area, or you got around a bit more?
No, actually, I only did one thing in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
To be honest, I was more on vacation. But it was an exciting one, in fact.
Uh-huh. Where in Oakland? That being a place I know a lot better than San Diego.
Well, you see, I don't. So I was driven there, and I'm not. I think north. It was North Oakland.
But what sort of place? Community center, church?
Oh, it was. I've forgotten what it's called. There's a number of groups that meet together. It's like the Institute for something, and there's a Marxist something library.
Oh yeah, the Marxist library. I know people there.
They do a number of events there. In fact, I was like the next week they were going to have David Bacon, who's one of the really great people on this issue, to speak. So, they put it together at the last minute, and we had something like 18 people, and they. This was another thing where you had people who were basically pro-immigrant, but they had a lot of different takes on it. Some of them from the point of view, in fact, one woman who was there was basically somebody who was sort of a progressive middle-class person said, well, immigrants just take jobs that we don't want. And this woman who was herself an immigrant said, yes, my husband is a printer. And in fact, he's in competition with new immigrants who are working for less in the same job, and I simply don't believe that, which I think it's important to get these questions out there.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I'm not by any means trying to diss your efforts here, because, I mean, even if we aren't reaching folks who are outside of progressive circles and more or less share a progressive consensus on these questions, it's still important, for amongst ourselves to hash out our positions and to be informed. And
these are people who are talking to other people,
which is
important.
Absolutely.
I think when Jane was giving the rundown, she didn't say we've done one event in Montclair, New Jersey, and we'd like to put in a pitch here. We would love to talk to more people in more places in New Jersey, and hopefully we're going to have something soon in Long Island, but we'd like to do... problems aren't just in San Diego County.
Right. Oh,
there's
not
a lot of that going on in Long Island, of course, and a lot of it going on in New Jersey.
And in Queens and elsewhere around the city.
Well, but in Queens,
not so
they're not
in
so
Queens.
not so many of the people on the ground have this, you know, like hardcore anti-immigrant feeling.
But right. But in terms of confronting
the issues.
And those
who do are seriously outnumbered in Queens.
I mean, sure. I live in Queens.
We both live in Queens.
I got on the subway with a woman one day, like, who said, oh, there's too many of these people here. And I looked at her, and I looked around the car, and I think she and I were probably the only native-born people on the car.
Oh,
I thought, well, I don't think she's courageous. I think she's just stupid.
Well, and in contradistinction to San Diego, the more conservative part of the county would be in the south anyway. Queens County, that is.
Right.
Yes.
Although, yeah, that's also, I mean, New York City just in general is very, very diverse. But, I mean, San Diego County is, you know, there's a lot of Latinos in San Diego County, too. It's not diverse in the way Queens is with that many that many different ethnicities mixed together. But, I mean, I think it's important to, you know, the point of these dialogues is not, you know, that the progressive, you know, people sit around and, you know, sort of hash out their positions. The idea is really to give people the tools that they need to go out there and engage in dialogue with other people who disagree with them. So everybody's got family members and or coworkers and or friends or, you know, people they deal with on a regular basis who are confronting them on these issues. And so people need the tools to be able to do that. And even just to confront the stuff they're bombarded with in the media. You know, to know how to answer this.
Right, absolutely.
And one of the things that we do is encourage people to write letters to the editor and to also, you know, on the online newspapers, they usually have these comment sections. And there's a lot of anti-immigrant stuff that gets voiced in the comment sections after any article that touches on immigration.
In you mean just in the daily newspapers?
In any, right, any
coast to coast, yeah.
Online newspaper.
Right.
I mean, all the ones that allow comment sections.
Right. Yes.
There seem to be a very, you know, probably very small, but very vocal and very, you know,
definitely
very busy doing this kind of group of people who spend all their time posting nasty comments, some of them incredibly nasty. And what ends up happening is, you know, it ends up being this sort of overwhelming barrage of anti-immigrant comments at the end of any article on immigration. And so really encouraging people to, you know, get the tools that they need, the information to put responses to, and then go up there. And even if you just do one article every day or even one article every week, if everybody does it, then, you know, it'll start to
and on the
give
subject,
some encouragement to people who get overwhelmed by this.
I should note that you don't do one article every week, but you do several articles every week. And Jane mostly has been producing immigration news briefs for how long now?
Since 1998, although it started out as a monthly, but it became a weekly, I think, in late 2001.
Right. And so. The you guys together have been doing weekly news update on the Americas under the auspices of the Nicaragua Solidarity Network of Greater New York for, what, 15 years or something?
More, since 1990.
Wow.
So
congratulations, guys.
So almost February 1990, so it's almost 18 years. Yeah.
Almost every week in that entire period.
Yeah. It was every week until the last,
last year or so.
Year or so when we started working
on the book. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But well, anyway, what suddenly made me think to bring up your bona fides here, which I should have done at the top of the show, is that, you know, I post your material, of course, from both of your newsletters on my own website. And I don't know if you've noticed or not, but your immigration news briefs blurbs have elicited a lot of very ugly comments from readers.
No, I hadn't noticed that,
yeah,
actually.
From Minutemen type who, you know, types who comment and say, I mean, you'll post about the latest atrocious Border Patrol raid or ICE raid, and, you know, somebody will write a comment saying, you know, go Border Patrol, kick them out, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it happens pretty regularly, you know.
Right.
I think there's something that's interesting about that should be pointed out is that the immigration news briefs is a news digest, and it's, in fact, very, you know, very carefully based on, you know.
Oh, totally.
Other materials. In other words, it's not Jane expressing her opinions.
Right.
It's based on material from news sources and other sources, and it's very, very factual. And
absolutely.
Frequently, it seems that factual things get these people upset.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, they're not, you know, they're not out there with sort of addressing the issues with any kind of facts. They're just out there to sort of stir up anger and stir up, you know, and voice their own anger and just kind of, it's you know, it operates on a sort of, they're trying to get emotional resonance on the issue.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, that's their goal. Yeah. And, you
and
know,
I think also.
And then trying to, and I think also trying to provoke people and really trying to, I think, I don't know, you know, it seems like it's a goal to, that they would have a goal of making themselves seem more numerous than they are, so that they, you know, those who are very vocal spend a lot of time getting their voice out there, and certainly their voices are amplified beyond the level that they actually represent in society. I mean, somebody was just commenting last night. Actually, we were on KPFK radio in LA, and the host of that show was commenting that there's a new study out that shows that 90% of Americans don't think immigration is a major issue. They don't see it as a key issue. So I thought this was pretty interesting. And I mean, maybe it was they don't see it as a key issue in the elections. That was probably what it was. I haven't looked at the study itself. But
In fact, it's from FAIR, not the anti-immigrant FAIR, but from Fairness and Accuracy in Media, in reporting.
What's the anti-immigrant FAIR?
I've forgotten what it's
Federation
called.
Federation of...
I'll look it up on the web anyway.
Yeah.
No, I forgot.
But I want to clarify which it is.
Right.
But yeah, they based on Pew, I guess Pew Institute had listed major concerns of most people in terms of the elections it's Iraq, it's the economy, it's healthcare, it's, you know, immigration is way down there on the list. I think what's even more significant is that the polls show that people in general are not anti-immigrant or pro-immigrant. They are conflicted. The people in the middle are the vast majority. And one of the things these people who write the comments, I think, are trying to do, and I think that you're getting from Lou Dobbs and a lot of the mainstream media, is get this sense that no, the country is ferociously anti-immigrant,
mm-hmm.
and that this is the mainstream. And in fact, it's not the mainstream. The mainstream is conflicted. And then you have the approach, like the Democratic Party approach. I believe Representative Emmanuel Rahm, who's their big strategist, said, oh, immigration is the third rail of American politics. We mustn't touch it. And I think, you know, I think we should touch it. I think people are in the middle, and if we can get out there with facts and common sense, it's going to give them a lot to think about.
Did you, by the way, that's the Federation for American Immigration Reform, as opposed to Fairness and Accuracy Reporting.
Yeah.
So did you see yesterday's Times about what's going on in Maricopa County, Arizona, where the Jornaleros have been lining up outside a particular hardware store who's been calling in the Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Oh, yeah. He's a real character.
He's certainly, to say the least, he's a real character.
Yeah.
And he seems to, what is he, like sheriff for life? He's been in there for, like, what, 15 years or something now.
I don't think sheriffs aren't elected, are they?
Yeah, for the most part.
Are they?
Yeah. I mean, I think it varies from county to county and state to state, but I think he's elected. I'm pretty sure he is. In any event, so, I mean, it's just... it just looks like this absolute show where it's like, you know, the battle of the showdown in Arizona, writes Lawrence Downs, an editorial Observer column. Showdown in Arizona where mariachis and Minutemen collide. And, you know, the people who support the Jornaleros are out there with their guitars and their mariachis. And then you've got the Minutemen who are out there with bullhorns, chanting, apparently, this is his verbatim, monkeys coming through, in reference to the mariachis. Born in the USA, born in the USA, KKK, Viva la Migra, January 1st, which is a reference to an ordinance which has been passed in the state of Arizona, which takes effect January 1st, which starts punishing companies that hire illegal workers. So... you know, one wonders if things aren't, you know, at least with the hardcore minority out there, you know, it's sort of past the point of dialogue. You know, I'm not quite sure exactly.
We're not interested in dialogue with the hardcore minority. We're interested in dialogue with the other people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The people who are, like, being ignored in this, basically.
Right. The hardcore minority is a very small minority.
One hopes.
They're like I said, their voices are amplified.
Certainly.
To a very large extent by the media and by politicians. Mm-hmm. They have their extremist kind of position it's sort of larger than life. You know,
and yet they do get people out for their rallies and so on. And
not large numbers.
Well, certainly not like we witnessed last spring on the other side of the equation.
No.
Right. Nowhere near that much.
Spring of 2006.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Last spring, yeah.
But, I mean, this is the way the media has operated my entire life. It's like even when my children were young, they would watch television. They would say, oh, there was a peace demonstration. I guess now we're going to see the sizable counter demonstration. And
right.
We give equal time between a demonstration of 100,000 people and 18 people against the demonstration on the other side. And as for equal time, the 18 people were supporting the position usually of the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. They thought they would get equal time already, but
I mean, and that's definitely the case with these anti-immigrant demonstrations in virtually everywhere. I mean, you know, I don't want to say every single one, but virtually everyone that has happened, every time there's a anti-immigrant counter-demonstration to an immigrant rights demonstration, it's been, you know, usually one or two people counter-demonstrating. And then when they organize their own rallies and they really work to get people out, they're often outnumbered by immigrant rights demonstrators counter-protesting their demonstration. So, yeah, their numbers are small. The problem is that their voice is amplified. And so the idea is to really, you know, give people the facts that they need to start chipping away at this sort of
and make sure that they understand that, you know, the people who are in the middle understand, no, they're not a minority. They are the majority, so they should ask questions. They should talk. They should not just feel that they have to shut up because the Minutemen and Lou Dobbs dominate the so-called debate.
Mm-hmm. Well, once again, we're speaking with Jane Guskin and David Wilson, who are the co-authors of The Politics of Immigration, Questions and Answers. And I just found my own copy here. If it was a snake, it would have bit me. Fraud Off the Presses from Monthly Review Press here in New York City. And I should say, if I haven't yet, that this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm Bill Weinberg. Anne Marie Hendrickson may show her face tonight, or maybe not. She'll be back next week, or eventually. This book is, in fact, organized in a Q&A format, and like all of Jane and Dave's work, it's loaded with information. It's very fact-laden, and it provides the whole ins and outs of immigration policy going all the way back to when? When did this first exactly start to become an issue? Over 100 years ago, the federal government actually passed the first immigration law, and before that it was pretty much an open border.
Right. I mean, that's the way to look at it, is that for the first 99 years, if you start from 1776, there were no immigration laws at all.
All right, so what year was the first immigration law?
The first immigration law was from 1875, mm-hmm. and it officially says it's for the purposes of stopping the importation of women for prostitution, which sounds like something, I mean, how could you be against that? But actually, the motivation of it, as the people who proposed it made very clear, the motivation was they suddenly realized that the 14th Amendment meant that if you were an immigrant here, even if you couldn't be naturalized, your children, if they were born here, would become U.S. citizens. And the native-born people in California, or the native-born, the people mostly hadn't been born in California, the people who are doing this, they looked at that and realized, oh, we brought in all these Chinese workers. And if their wives come and they have children here, their children will be U.S. citizens just like us. And we can't allow that. Now, people frequently say the immigration issue has nothing to do with racism. The first immigration law was clearly racist. It was to keep people from Chinese workers from bringing in their wives, who could be classified as prostitutes on the grounds that the authorities here couldn't read Chinese, so they couldn't see the marriage certificate. I'm being literal. I'm not joking about this. They stopped people's wives from coming, and that's what it was for. When they wanted to make sure that, you know, that wasn't quite enough, so in 1882 they had the first official immigration law, which was the Chinese Exclusion Act. Once again, if you think there's nothing involving racism in this? Listen to the name of that, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882.
Blatant. It was quite blatant. All right, I'm sorry, but the first one you say was 10 years before that.
1875.
Uh-huh. Okay, so when you say that the one in the 1880s was the first official one, what's the distinction here?
The first one that officially says we're excluding one group of people.
Oh, yes, right, the first officially racist one.
Right.
Well, that was fairly open right through the 1920s, wasn't it? I mean, even the big bill in the 1920s, well, it was actually called the... Something Exclusion Act, wasn't it?
Well, if you're starting from a point of open borders, then all your immigration laws are going to be about excluding people, right?
Right.
I mean, that's...
right, but the one...
Because you're starting from a position of letting everybody in.
Right, but
if you're going to make laws, they're going to be about excluding people. And, of course, you know, since racism is, you know, the name of the game and has been for
The 1924 law
right.
was... Since by that time they had already passed laws excluding all Asians mm-hmm. except Filipinos mm-hmm. who were, because the U.S. was in control of the Philippines, were counted as U.S. nationals. It wasn't necessary to do that with Asians. This is the point at which they decided, well, we have to exclude all those people from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, all those Jews
right.
and Italians and so on. So that's what the 1924 law was about, and it was quite clear about that. They tried a formula based on who was here in 1890 and so on. They realized, oh, that would still include too many Italians and Russians and Jews, so they changed the formula. They kept on changing the formula until they came up with one that would only allow, basically, only allow Northern Europeans to immigrate to the country.
Mm. Okay, but was that the last time, in your estimation, that... on the federal legislative level, it was, you know, fairly overtly racist in terms of, you know, we're just favoring people of this particular nationality. And
well, those laws and amendments to those laws and extensions of those laws continued until 1965,
right,
in fact.
Right.
So they went on for 41 years.
And meanwhile, you had the McCarran-Walter Act, which sort of shifted the exclusion to the ideological as opposed to the racist.
The ideological and also the sexual deviant category
was expanded. Right. Indeed, yes.
Which, in other words, gay people were going to be kept out. They would be very careful to keep them out. And they did, at some point when they wanted to make friends with General Chiang Kai-shek, they changed the Chinese part and decided to allow in some Chinese. Mm-hmm. I think it was in the category of 120 per year. Mm-hmm. But, people act as though these laws were way in the distant past, and maybe depending on your age, to me, they're not in the distant past. That was 1965. It was finally taken away.
Well, and the 1952 law is still the basic law on the books. The McCarran-Walter Act is the 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act. That's still the basis of all existing immigration law.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's cited. You cite INA, you know, blah, 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 whatever in the legal cases.
Right. The 1965 law changes the quota system.
Right. They changed parts of it through various subsequent laws, but that's the basis, the 1952.
And one of the results of this, by the way, is that during the 1930s, when Jews were trying to escape persecution in Germany and in other parts of Europe, they were not allowed to come to the United States. I believe I just came out recently that while people, you know, like become very sentimental over Anne Frank died because the United States would not accept her family, even though her father was a business person and through his education was well connected in the United States. He still, with influence and so on, still could not get his family to this country.
What efforts did they make?
He went to college with a number of people who were, you know, prominent business people in the United States, and they wrote to the State Department and said, give these people visas and so on, and they were denied over and over again.
And you tell the story in the book of the St. Louis, the ship which was holed up in Havana and turned away by FDR?
The St. Louis was... The Nazis finally allowed a large number of mostly Jewish refugees to take this, you know, well-to-do, by the way, since they could afford to go on an ocean liner,
right,
to take the ocean liner to Cuba. They were hoping that they could stop in Cuba and then they would be able eventually to get visas to rejoin their families, because they mostly had families here, in the United States if they were allowed in Cuba. I have a friend whose uncle, in fact, did do that. I don't know the ins and outs of how he did it. He was not on that ship. But when the ship got there, the right wing in Cuba has said, decided to make an issue out of it. We don't want all these European Jews to come here. So the Cuban government changed and said, no, we're not going to let them get off in Cuba. The ship started steaming towards the United States while they cabled them and asked for permission for emergency visas and so on. The U.S. said, no, no. And in fact, I think Jane maybe has the exact quote, but basically the U.S. said, no, you have to wait your turn in line, which is one of the favorite expressions with immigration over and over again.
Which we still hear today.
In this case, their turn in line was basically in Auschwitz. Most of those people were killed.
Right. It was like 900 on the ship, of which 600.
600, I believe. Yeah. You know, almost all of them were taken back to Europe, and the majority of them died in the concentration camps.
And what year was that whole affair? How late in the day was that?
It turned back towards Europe on June 6, 1939. It arrived, it sailed from Hamburg in May 1939. Mm-hmm. So it was May, June 1939.
Right. So pretty late in the day.
And the thing I was actually looking up here was about your question about the ideological exclusions in the 1952 McCarran-Walter Act. Most of the ideological provisions, along with the ban on homosexuals, were formally repealed by Congress in 1990, although many were reincorporated in the USA Patriot Act in 2001.
Ah, great.
So that's that's the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yet, I mean, the whole mobilization that we saw last year was in response to a far worse piece of legislation, which we, meaning the movement, I think can take credit for defeating, though.
I mean, it was, you know, it was certainly interesting to see how quickly things can change in Congress based on a real mass movement in the streets. I mean, I think that was the lesson of it. And as the mass movement dissipated, the right wing anti-immigrant forces really consolidated that amplification of their voices and of their power. So even though they didn't have the numbers in the streets and they knew they couldn't get those numbers in the streets, they were able to regain some ground in the wake of those protests. And so now we have a situation where really it's worse than it was before.
Okay, how so? How is it worse than it was before?
Well, I mean, I guess it's not worse in the sense that nothing's actually been passed, but it's not clear that anything would have really been passed then, because the House had passed this bill, but the Senate, really, it's not clear whether the Senate would have passed a version of H.R. 4437, the bill that everybody was protesting. The Senate, in fact, you know, right after the protest, the Senate passed a bunch of progressive legislation, which, of course, went nowhere because then it had to be reconciled with the House bill, which was, you know, and there was just nothing to reconcile. There were two complete opposite, you know, opposite pieces of legislation. And so that just fell apart and it didn't happen. But I would say the climate right now is considerably more negative towards immigrants than it was prior to the demonstrations in 2006. And also the enforcement climate has been stepped up considerably.
Absolutely.
Now, that had started before the protests, and it was stepped up right around the time of the protests. There was one large national raid in April 2006. That a lot of people complained at the time was really seemed to be serving as intimidation to keep people from participating in further protests. So,
where was that?
That wasn't the Swift one, right? You know, I'm terrible with dates.
That's
I don't
right,
remember
boy,
which
gosh.
Was the one. It was one of, you know, they've done a couple of these big national ones where they target, like, a bunch of different.
All right, so it was like more of several coordinated raids, like a sweep kind of thing, as opposed to.
It was like a large coordinated
operation.
Sweep at a bunch
right.
of
yeah.
different.
Right.
It was
right.
the
right.
warehouse. It was the warehouse
the
one,
warehouse
right?
One, yes.
It was like a pallet company. IFCO pallet company.
IFCO
or something?
Pallet company.
IFCO
right.
pallet company. Yeah, that's what it was.
Where were they?
In a bunch of different cities. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had a bunch of different locations, factory and office locations around the country, and they were all simultaneously raided by ICE. Mm-hmm. They picked up. It was over 1,000 people that were arrested mm-hmm. in that. So. You know, it was similar in scope to the Swift raids. Which were the meatpacking raids.
Yes.
Which happened later, right?
Right.
December 2006, right?
Yeah. Right.
Just but about
yeah,
a year
the
ago.
The IFCO one was, yeah, exactly.
And I think we should keep in mind the question of how these are used as intimidation. And the IFCO raids certainly seemed to be an effort to intimidate people at the time of these huge demonstrations, whereas many of the other raids seem to be pretty much targeting labor organizing.
Yeah, and just I think it's a good illustration of one of the things that we're constantly trying to point out to people, both in the book and in these dialogue sessions, is how even if you were to, regardless of how you actually feel about the presence of immigrants here, that all of the enforcement serves to exacerbate some of the problems that result from having a large underclass of undocumented workers here. So there are various problems that result from having this large underclass of workers. Now the question is, what do you want to do about that? You can resolve it by giving them all documents, or you can theoretically try to resolve it by trying to deport them all, by trying to, you know, penalize the employers, by trying all these enforcement measures that are underway now. And all of those enforcement measures have the opposite effect, or the opposite of a positive effect. So they have this negative impact, which is to make it harder for workers to organize, make it harder for workers to defend their rights, push the wages down, and, you know, basically not resolve any of the underlying problems, which then you've got to get into what leads people to become immigrants to come here in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the final section of your book, you actually make the case for open borders, which is pretty gutsy. I mean, even progressives on the issue are often quite afraid of that particular terminology. So,
yeah, you know, one of the things that that is kind of disturbing is how so many people on the immigration issue who favor immigrant rights are really afraid to talk about anything like open borders or to even just call anything by what it is. You know, it's like, oh, we can't call it an amnesty now. We have to say compassionate and comprehensive immigration reform. Well, you know, does that really even mean anything to anyone? You know, and they use all these, and then they use a lot of bogus arguments like, you know, well, they're just taking jobs no one else wants and all these things. So, I mean, that's another thing that we really hope to do with the book, is to really disabuse liberals of these bogus arguments and the just the kind of not helpful rhetoric. And, like, let's have a real discussion about this stuff. Let's use real language and talk about real scenarios and, you know, what would open borders look like and why can't we talk about it? You know, why is it that the right wing says, you know, oh, well, those people, those are open borders people, and then all the progressive pro-immigrant people say, no, we're not open borders people, we're not open borders people. Well, you know, that's really, you know, why not just say, well, let's talk about open borders?
Just playing devil's advocate here.
Right.
Wouldn't it be a recipe for chaos? Wouldn't it be a free-for-all? Doesn't every sovereign state have to have, you know, some control over its borders?
The truth is, of course, if Jane and I suddenly were running the country and we suddenly opened up the borders,
without doing any of the other things
that would be necessary, then, of course, it would be chaos. It would be chaos for a while, of course. After a while, things would start to even out. But no, we would not propose doing that. We would propose, we are talking about, you know, this is the classic thing. When there's a problem in the world, people say, the people who've brought us to this problem say, well, what is your solution?
Yes,
my first
exactly.
solution is, I wouldn't have brought it to this situation.
Thank you.
But yeah.
But the way I always like to talk about it is, first of all, well, let's talk about what's your solution. The people who talk about enforcement, let's go through enforcement point by point and explain how building a fence on the border is actually going to stop immigration. You know, how it's there to stop it. How all the enforcement efforts that have taken place over the past 20 years, which have been very expensive and have caused a lot of suffering among people crossing the border, have they actually stopped the number of people crossing the border? And the answer is no. So why don't we discuss that? Why don't we discuss what goes on with immigration, with the enforcement of on the borders, and also another good question is, who is making a lot of money off the enforcement? And you see it's the same old defense contractors who've always been making money off things, and they come up with the same things that we're going to stop. Like, to go back to my youth, the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam, they're going to use the same brilliant technology that stopped South Vietnam from being infiltrated. It's just amazing. And then to top it off, and the New York Times was talking about this yesterday, now Blackwater has moved to the border.
Yes, Blackwater
is trying to get into the border control business.
Also, just on the open borders question, I mean, I think that the whole idea of whether it would be chaos, I mean, obviously, if you open the borders tomorrow, people are not going to be confident that that's going to be a policy that is going to last. And so people are going to be like, all right, I'm going to rush in now. But if it was done in a way where it was sort of clear that it was an ongoing change in policy and was also accompanied with changes in policy and foreign policy and economic policy, all these global economic policy, all these things that would theoretically help allow people who would rather stay in their communities to do so and survive. So if you did something in a more rational way, I don't think you would really be flooded, because you would also have a lot of people here who, if they knew they could leave and come back, there's a lot of people who have been trapped here. And that's one of the things that the enforcement, the stepped up enforcement on the border particularly, has done, is that a lot of people who, especially Mexicans, since the proximity, it was easier for them in the past to go back to Mexico for a period of time and then return here. Now most of them are feeling like it's not worth the risk, and they're not going back to Mexico. So I think, and you have a lot of people from other countries who just are trapped here waiting for the day that they're able to legalize their status so they can go back and visit family and relatives and their former homes and all that. So I think you would see movement in both directions. And I think you'd also see, if it was an ongoing policy, not just an open the doors today and slam them shut tomorrow. If it was an ongoing policy, I think you would see people coming here for a period of time to work and earn some money, and then going back home. I mean, I asked a close friend of mine who's Mexican, who lived in the States for a while and then returned to Mexico. I asked her, if you didn't have to deal with all this border stuff and all these document stuff, what would you do? Would you go back to the States and live there, or would you stay in Mexico? And she said, well, you know, I like Mexico. This is my home. I really would rather live here. I don't really want to live there. But I would like to go maybe for a few months out of the year and work, you know. And I think you'd find a lot of people, not everybody, you know, some people really want to live here. Other people don't want to come here at all. But you would find a lot of people who might want to come for short periods of time. And if things were set up in a way that encouraged people to know their rights and defend their rights as workers, and they weren't being denied their rights because of document issues, I think you'd see a different kind of situation. I think that, you know, I mean, so one of the things, for example, with the European Union, when they opened the borders initially to the particular, you know, the first group of countries that opened the borders.
Right, internally.
Internally, absolutely. Right. You know, the European Union has not opened its borders to the rest of the world.
Exactly.
In fact, wasn't there was just a news item today about 150 people died in the last few days trying to get into the European Union.
Oh, my goodness. Where?
Yeah.
Do you remember where?
In the Aegean.
Yeah, in the Aegean.
The boats sank in the Aegean.
Oh, my goodness.
A couple of boats sank in over a couple of days. Mm. But, oh, now I forgot what I was going to say. What was I saying?
well, you were talking about the analogy to what happened in the European Union.
And one of the things that they thought was going to happen was they thought everyone from Spain, which had a much lower, you know, income level, and Spain and Italy, you know, they were going to come rushing up to Germany and Britain and, you know, grab a bunch of jobs. And actually, that didn't really happen. And they actually got a lot of reverse migration from retirees from Britain, Britain particularly,
I think, probably,
Germans as well, moving down to better weather and cheaper living in Spain and Italy. So, you know, they had some sort of unexpected migration patterns, and I think we would see some unexpected migration patterns here, too.
Yeah, if I could just say about Britain, in fact, the right wing basically made it sound like the European Union was going to be the Spanish Armada is coming back and invading. And the problem, so many British retired people went to Spain that Spain had problems with the social security system, its healthcare system. It just wasn't prepared. It's as if we'd been cut off from Florida for all these years, and then suddenly it was opened up. But I think, you know, the European Union is certainly not a perfect model, mm-mm. but it's something to keep in mind is that when NAFTA was being sold in Mexico, the Mexican government kept on trying to tell Mexicans, yes, this is going to be, NAFTA is going to be the United States and Canada and Mexico, and it's going to be like the European Union. And Mexicans, who are by no means incapable of reading the newspapers and looking at the internet, said, but wait a second, in the European Union, as they were setting up the trade, as they were opening up the borders to trade, they were also having a phase opening up the borders for immigration between the different countries, whereas the United States is, in fact, stepping up enforcement on the border as we're doing this. How is this like the European Union?
Mm-hmm. Well, is Britain a part of the Schengen area, so-called?
No, it's not. Britain and Ireland are actually not part of it, but they I mean, for practical purposes, they're, you know, there's not really border controls with them. They have their own agreement between Britain and Ireland. They have their own sort of little thing, and it's complicated. Believe me, that part of the book took me a while to to straighten out the Schengen.
But I have a friend who got her job teaching English in Paris because her grandmother, they could prove her grandmother came to Michigan from a specific place in Ireland, and so suddenly she became an Irish person and could teach in France.
Indeed. You know, I need to look into that question for personal reasons. But, this sort of, the whole question of free trade and U.S. foreign policy, this sort of ties together that the two hats you guys wear. On one hand, Weekly News Update on the Americas, which documents all the human rights abuses and so on, which happen on a weekly basis without anybody paying very much notice in Latin America. And that is, not many people paying much notice this side of the border to what's happening in Latin America on an ongoing basis. And immigration news briefs about the whole enforcement atmosphere escalating and militarization here. And you sort of, in terms of a coherent policy, it would be sort of difficult to address one without addressing the other. But it strikes me that that's, getting from here to there strikes me as a really difficult item, given how far out of whack things have already, gotten.
Getting from where we are now to an open
exactly.
borders point.
Right. Even beginning to turn it around.
No, absolutely. I mean, and people say, oh, isn't that utopia? Yeah, well, the point of bringing it up is not to say, oh, here's something we can lobby Congress for. Obviously, this is not something that's going to be on the agenda nationally, but why not talk about it and why not look at it? And in general, just to look at it in contrast to the current system and say, look, the current system isn't working. So if we're going to go in a direction, why don't we go in a direction away from the current patterns of enforcement and towards something that's better? And I mean, in terms of linking up the issues, like, for example, what's going on in Latin America, what's going on in, the rest of the world, those that's incredibly important. I mean, you really can't address immigration without addressing the root causes of immigration and without acknowledging that there's a lot of people who really would rather stay in their countries and would rather not have to come here, and yet they feel like they really have no options for the future.
So, I mean, essentially been forced out by policies which the U.S. has imposed.
Absolutely. That the U.S. has imposed directly or encouraged, or situations where, for example, the people of a particular country decide they want to take things in a different direction, and then the U.S. government comes and stops them from doing it.
Well,
it's all these different levels.
Exactly.
It's what, through direct foreign policy intervention, through covert foreign policy intervention, and through economic pressures through the IMF and the World Bank, which are not technically legally the U.S. government,
process.
But they're.
I mean, we saw the whole counter-revolution in Central America 20 years ago, and now the fruit of it is CAFTA, which is just replicating, what they did with NAFTA 10 years ago.
Right.
So, what exactly were the measures which were in the House bill last year, which were defeated? What were the most onerous things that that legislation
were in H.R. 44437?
Right.
Yeah, which actually wasn't last year. It was actually passed in December 2005 by the House.
Right. But it became an issue when the Senate was moving to vote on it in
Yeah. I mean, that whole thing was actually very interesting. The sort of rise of that movement, which happened over the space. It was basically from Valentine's Day, February 14th, to May Day. Mm-hmm. That was the period of the mobilizations. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, really, it wasn't specifically about the specific content of H.R. 4437. That was
which people quite often call the Sensenbrenner Bill.
The Sensenbrenner Bill, yeah.
Named after its sponsor.
Yeah, but it wasn't really about the specifics in that bill. Those things, they were just so outrageous that they just kind of pissed people off. And then it was just one of those things that sometimes mass movements just, you know, the what do you call the straw that breaks the camel's back,
yes,
is what you're saying. It's la gota que rebasó el vaso, the drop that spilled over the glass of water. So, you know, it wasn't, I mean, that it was a trigger point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, one of the things was that it was going to make it a felony to cross the border without inspection, right? Isn't that right?
Yes.
And that it was going to penalize people. And
it's currently a misdemeanor.
Right.
Right.
And it's currently like a traffic ticket.
And well, being in a country out of status is a civil violation, mm-hmm, and it is like a traffic ticket. Crossing the border is a misdemeanor, so that's, mm-hmm, that's actually in the criminal code, it's, mm-hmm, not in the civil code. Mm-hmm. It's more serious. But, for the most part, the U.S. doesn't bother with that. The U.S. goes after the civil violation. Because when you have a criminal violation, then
you have to provide a lawyer.
Thanks to the Bill of Rights,
yes,
which has many good points, the U.S. would have to provide a lawyer,
yes,
in the criminal case.
They are experimenting with applying it in a couple of places in Texas. There's a couple of jurisdictions where they're kind of experimenting with slapping criminal charges of illegal entry on everybody they catch. But
really,
it's sort of like a pilot project.
The feds are doing this.
Yes. No, they have been doing
it's
it.
It's a
They've
federal offense.
Yeah. So,
but, I mean, there's like a few little places where they're doing this as a little test project kind of to see, you know, how it works out. And, yeah, the courts are getting sort of flooded.
But that's still basically in terms of intimidation because I guess I think the government's position is about 60% of the undocumented immigrants in the country have entered illegally. About 40% overstayed their visas. So 60% of, say, 12 million, late at night, I can't do math, but we're talking in the range of 8, 9 million people. I don't think they're going to want to provide defense lawyers for 8 or 9 million,
yes,
people.
Well, okay, the other thing is they can't actually prove that you entered the country illegally.
Right.
They can't prove it unless they catch you coming in over the border. Mm-hmm. So it's really only, I mean, they
right,
can't really
you
slap you with
your visa.
Well, no, I mean, for that you have to prove that you had a visa, but I mean, you could, I mean, they don't know.
They don't know.
I mean,
can't prove that you came in illegally. Is the point?
They can't prove that you.
But
right.
but to get back to the legal point a little bit, I know a certain number of people are going to think, but why should we provide lawyers for these people who are not here legally? And how come their children can be U.S. citizens and so on? And a lot of the politicians, you know, and writers like Pat Buchanan, they try to push on that point. And I want people who are native-born U.S. citizens should think very carefully because what they're talking about is opening up parts of the Bill of Rights and opening up parts of the 14th Amendment. And this is like surgery. You open a person up, you better know what you're doing because...
Right.
If these people, if people like Pat Buchanan and Lou Dobbs, if they get to open up the 14th Amendment, which is giving us all equal protection under the law, then we're in big trouble.
Right.
They start opening up the rights to due process, and in fact, of course, they are.
And
the
we should be
Guantanamo
clear here.
And so
we should
so
be clear
on.
Here that the well, they're not actually tinkering with the Constitution yet, although they certainly gutted the spirit of the Bill of Rights. But the point is that the actual text of the Bill of Rights refers, by and large, to the people, the rights of the people,
the
not,
rights of
not
the people,
of citizens,
yes,
per se.
And in fact, the 14th Amendment is part of the point of the 14th Amendment is to say it is the people, because the Dred Scott decision tried to say, oh, those rights are only for citizens.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the many things. It was unbelievably atrocious, even for a a bunch of slaveholders, I think, were the people in the Supreme Court who pushed that decision. But just unbelievable is that they said, oh, no, they didn't mean the people when they wrote that. I mean, talk about judicial activism. They mean citizens.
Right.
But a lot of the right-wing people now are trying to do the same thing. Again, the same thing of saying, well, the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to this category. It doesn't apply to that category. Mm-hmm. And everybody who's listening to this who think, if you think that can't happen to you, if they open up these things, yes, it can.
So the Sensenbrenner bill also would have criminalized...
helping
yes.
immigrants. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that's the kind of thing where...
It's helping undocumented immigrants.
Right. Helping people who are out of status.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, that pissed off, a lot of people as well.
That would have been made a felony in that bill as well?
I can't remember, actually, whether it would have been a felony or not. I mean...
All right, so my question is, you know, I mean, the anti-immigration forces argue up and down that, that they aren't racist. And that really they just want everybody to abide by the law and so on. So what's your response to this?
My personal response to that is always to ask people who are saying that, have you ever broken a law in your life? Because I think most people have broken at least one or two laws in their lives. Maybe exceeding the speed limit. Maybe you didn't get caught, but that still is breaking a law. So how is it that breaking of some laws is somehow judged as this terrible thing and breaking of other laws is not? Because that's not the only response to that, but that's, I just think it's really important for people to kind of reflect back on their own behavior. If you're going to call somebody...
I can anticipate the response to that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be that, well, I smoked a joint once 10 years ago. I broke the law once, but, these people are sort of... illegal as a status. Their actual status in the country is illegal.
It's not. It's actually just a civil violation. It's not. Their actual status here of being here without permission is not a crime at all.
If they cross the border, which counts as a misdemeanor, they cross the border once.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing.
Okay.
It's the same argument. But I think the other way to look at it is, as we said earlier, the first 99 years we didn't have immigration laws at all. The laws came from somewhere. What was the purpose of the law? Who got these laws? What were the laws? What were the laws directed against? Who were they directed against? And are the laws good? That's another way to, there are many, many laws that reflect things that are like universal human values.
Mm-hmm.
Immigration laws are not in that category. Countries have had immigration laws. Countries have taken away immigration laws.
Another thing that can be pointed out is, it was illegal to escape slavery at one time. Was it wrong for people to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the same arguments were made, in fact. Well, you must obey the law. You shouldn't. And there were laws against aiding the runaway slaves in the northern states.
Okay, good points. Well, do you want to... consider mixing it up with the listeners, having a dialogue
sure.
on the air?
Why not?
Should we take some phone calls? I should say that it's 2 minutes after 1 o'clock in the morning on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I'm Bill Weinberg. We're speaking with Jane Guskin and David L. Wilson, co-authors of The Politics of Immigration, Questions and Answers, hot off the press from... Monthly Review, and maybe we'll take your phone calls at 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. After we hear a little bit more of the Tigres del Norte, should we hear some more of the Tigres? There's a song which you reference in the book. Have I got it here? Yeah. Jaula de Oro?
Jaula de Oro.
You want to say something about that?
Cage of Gold. It's a great song. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say about it other than I think it's a great song that really captures...
Well, what is the Cage of Gold?
This country, basically. Being in this country without documents, being trapped here and not belonging here because this country doesn't accept you and yet not quite belonging back home anymore in your country.
All right, so why don't we give that a listen and then we'll take... some listener phone calls at 212-209-2900. Hello.
Aquí estoy establecido en los Estados Unidos. 10 años pasaron ya. En que crucé de mojado y papeles no he arreglado. Sigo siendo un ilegal. Tengo mi esposa y mis hijos, que me los traje muy chicos y se han olvidado ya. Del que yo nunca me olvido y no puedo regresar. ¿De qué me sirve el dinero si estoy como prisionero dentro de esta gran nación? Cuando me acuerdo hasta lloro, que aunque la jaula sea de oro, no deja de ser prisión.
Escúchame, hijo. ¿Te gustaría que regresáramos a vivir a México?
What you talking about, Dad? I don't want to go back to Mexico. No way, Dad.
Mis hijos no hablan conmigo. Otro idioma han aprendido y olvidado el español. Piensan como americanos. Niegan que son mexicanos, aunque tengan mi color. De mi trabajo a mi casa, yo no sé lo que me pasa, que aunque soy hombre de hogar, casi no salgo a la calle, pues tengo miedo que me hallen y me puedan deportar. Estoy como prisionero dentro de esta gran nación. Cuando me acuerdo hasta lloro, que aunque la jaula sea de oro, no deja de ser prisión.
Okay, here we are. Once again, the number is 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. If anybody out there has anything to say to or ask of Jane Guskin and David Wilson, co-authors of The Politics of Immigration. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Basically, what you're talking about is basically your Eurocentric situation. They've made conflicts in other countries, and you know, now you're saying this one's not coming across this border, or that border, and there was no borders before that, not in the way that that is set up. You know, so you got the problems in Africa, Asia. All these different places, the United States, and these other people are in those countries. You got golf courses being built in New Zealand, Australia, all these different places. These are Aborigine people who have been displaced, but nobody ever talks about it. The African American who's here now is an Aboriginal person who was displaced, who refurbished the whole islands and everything because the people were dying out. But nobody ever brings this up.
Those are great points. I think that it is very important to note that the borders are artificial, that the peoples were there before the borders. And that's actually something a lot of people of Mexican descent in the Southwest say, is they say, we didn't cross the border crossed us. Actually, the song
we
played at the
with,
beginning says that. And the displacement issue is absolutely key. And also, I think you make a great point in talking about the way in which the big corporations from this country and from, European countries go into countries in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and, you know, put in their golf courses and put in their corporations and take resources. They take resources away from people who are then left without resources, even though they come from a place of great great resource wealth.
So. The other thing is the so-called assimilation. I live in a town. I'm looking at the South Americans. The models that they have in the window have blonde hair.
Yeah.
So this situation is that they're making them dislike their own self.
Right. That's the.
I mean, this goes for Africa or wherever. Yeah. Doesn't make any difference.
Right.
Wherever they're at. Even back if you look at some of the history between Britain and Ireland, there was some kind of friction or some kind of super superiority that the British had.
So
whatever they was thinking about, I don't know what they were thinking about.
Certainly was.
So there's a whole, see, racism, the African-American who's got some sense realizes racism from all the nationalities. They can be blacker than we are, and they think that they're better than us. This is a deeper thing than a lot of people. What's in it? Matter of fact, some of us look just like them. We can look like a black Afghani or a black Pakistani. And when they see us, they almost have a daggone fit. People got to understand this because this other racism has been put on them to be accepted in this society. There's a deeper thing than most people. What's that? Because we had a brown bag policy. If you was darker than the brown bag, you couldn't get into the party. And a lot of people from Africa and other places don't understand this. But we understand it, so we see a whole lot of kind of racism that's right there. In some cases, we the African American get along better than with the Caucasian. We can get along with the other indigenous people because they've been brainwashed.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of internalized racism that happens. I mean, racism is both institutionalized and internalized in this country and throughout the world in different ways. It sort of plays out in different ways in different places, and it's also one of the effects of colonialism is just this the sort of self-hate that's imposed on people, and this idea that the country that colonizes you is somehow superior, and it becomes sort of internalized. It has a terrible effect on people.
Okay, thanks for your call. Let's see who else is out there. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi.
Okay, thanks for your call.
No, turn down the radio, please. Turn down the radio.
Okay.
Okay.
Jane and David, you started to say, you said, well, if you were king, if you were running the government, what would you do? And you started to say, you said, well, at the beginning there would be chaos. And then you went off to something, you kind of wandered away from it. So let's go back to it. If you were in charge, what would you do, and how would you do it? Let's hear it.
Okay, I really don't want to be in charge. I will just repeat what I said before. The people who are in charge leave you with a terrible situation, and then they say, what are you going to do about it? Right now, there are obvious solutions. It's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen by some politician taking over and suddenly doing it.
What are the
obvious solutions? Number one, with immigration, the majority of people who immigrate here probably don't want to immigrate here. They're immigrating because of the conditions that are going on in their countries, as Bill was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. Very largely, people are coming from Mexico, and they're reacting to economic policies that were imposed on Mexico by the United States. They were imposed on the Mexican people, frequently with the active collaboration of the Mexican government and rich Mexicans, but in fact were imposed through like at least a million campesinos off their farms. And those policies, which hurt us here in other ways, we should oppose these, and they should, that's the first thing would be to stop that sort of policy and to allow Mexico and Central America and the Caribbean countries to develop in their own way, at their own pace, and then there would be much less of an immigration problem, And the immigration problem might be what we were talking about with Spain and Britain. Lots of people from this country would love to retire to those countries if the economic situations were better there. So that's, you know, that's the basic thing that I would be talking about. I'm really more interested in talking about not what happened if I were dictator, but what we can do on the ground now. And I think, you know, at some point we should get back to that.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm asking. So what should we do now?
Okay, I can tell you, like, we can't change the U.S. trade policies, but we can certainly, for instance, we can certainly help people who are trying to improve their situation in Mexico through direct solidarity. Like, just in the past 2 weeks, I think it's Vaqueros Nevada, which is a maquiladora that makes your genes, or that assembles your genes, or that assembles some people's genes in this country and in Canada. They finally were able to get a legally recognized, or at least they voted for a legally recognized independent union, which would improve their situation. A lot of that they attributed to, you know, the workers there said it was because of people in Canada and the United States putting pressure on the brands. So that sort of work, the sort of solidarity with people organizing in other countries, that's an important step to making things better.
And we can influence trade policy in some ways. So I believe that right now the Peru Free Trade Agreement is still
has been passed.
Oh, it was
passed? It's absolutely there.
Yeah.
I think we shouldn't get too focused on how we can influence Congress, because I think Congress reacts to big mass movements. I send the letters and make the phone calls sometimes too, but let's not put too much hope in that. Let's talk much more about about enlightening
people. People to people solidarity.
Also, when you hear, for instance, Lou Dobbs and Pat Buchanan, when they're trying to put on their populist act and saying, oh, well, they're against these free trade policies too, you say, no, actually they're not. These people are violently anti-union, for one thing. One of the big things that people need in the other countries, and that undocumented immigrants and native-born people in this country too need, is the ability to organize, to get better wages and get better communities and so on. If you're not for that, then you're not really opposed to the policies the government's doing now.
Well, isn't that, aren't you suggesting that we Americans then interfere even more in the economics of other countries?
It's not interfering. We're saying that when workers are asking for solidarity, whether those workers are in another country or in this country, when workers are trying to organize, they're trying to defend their rights. When peoples are trying to organize, trying to defend their rights, defend their land rights, indigenous peoples defending their land rights, when people are trying to defend their resource, the control of their resources, and they're asking for solidarity, then it's not interfering if you respond to their request for solidarity. Now, if you go down there and you say, I think you should do X, Y, and Z, and you try to pressure them to do it, then yes, you're interfering. But if they're asking for solidarity and you're providing them with the kind of solidarity that they're asking for,
What do you mean by solidarity?
Well, what I said specifically, for instance, in the case of this plant, the workers said, put pressure on the brands of genes that we're stitching here to, you know, put pressure back on the owners of this plant to allow a free union election. We're not interfering with what's happening in Mexico. We're talking to the U.S. and Canadian firms that are profiting from having what's basically a company union in that plant. And in fact, they did react. They said to the plant, well, maybe you should allow a free election.
My husband was a union lawyer. So that I'm not anti-union.
I'm sure you're not. Thank you.
Yeah, but I am. So what you're saying then is that we ought to work to help other countries to raise their standard of living, so that they will not want to emigrate here.
Well, I think that shouldn't be our motivation. I think our motivation should be that we want. We're in favor of people having good lives wherever they are, and we're opposed to policies that make their lives worse. You know, I think that's what we're doing, and supporting them, yes, supporting them in their union actions is the same thing. If there's a picket line down the street right here in New York, I'm not going to cross it, and I think when workers are trying to organize in a plant in Mexico, they've set up a picket line that we shouldn't cross either.
And also, you know, we really should address the fact that our government is doing a lot of things in other countries that are harming people and harming people's rights. And so for us to stop that is not intervening in those countries. It's actually trying to stop our government from negatively intervening.
I'm not familiar with what you're talking about. What kinds of things?
Oh, wars, military intervention, sending tear gas, which is, you know, used to crush protests.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of things. Some of it happens off the radar, and some of it, you know, people are aware of.
And, you know, and very directly, you know, there are about 2 million Central American immigrants here who came during the 1980s. Now, the U.S. was funding a ferocious war, which resulted in the death of 300,000 people in three countries in Central America during that period of time.
Mm.
Many of us were actually trying to oppose that, and the majority of people in this country actually were opposed to it. The government went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah.
Many of the people who were supporting that, like Pat Buchanan, who was a speechwriter for Reagan at the time, now they say, well, where do all these Salvadorans come from? Well, actually, Pat, you brought them here. You created a war that drove them out of their country, and they came here, and now you're complaining about them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I'm not saying we as people in the United States are all guilty of these things. What I'm saying is that our government did these things in our name, and we should be fighting against it.
Yeah. Well, I think that if we could improve the wage level in other countries, then maybe some of that business would come back to us, because I remember when we were with the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, which was a men's clothing union, and then we took in the International Lady Garment Workers,
right,
and the shoe manufacturers and so on. And so what happened was that we organized in the northern factories, and they moved, and the factories moved south, and then we organized in the south, and they went offshore.
Right.
And that's happened with a number of industries, to the point where at this point some 70% of our economic activity here is selling services, because you can't really offshore waiters and waitresses.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
But so that I do agree, if we could, if there's some way that we can raise the income levels in other countries, then maybe some of those factories will come back home, you know?
And the idea is really to have a race to the top instead of a race to the bottom, which is the current situation we have, as you say, that the sort of workers competing with each other globally, you know, pushing the wages down, or the companies pushing the wages down because they can move the job here or there where workers get paid less. And so that's creating a race to the bottom. And through this sort of acts of solidarity with workers who are organizing in various parts of the world, we can work towards pushing that standard of living up for everybody.
Well, very good. We had some actual dialogue there, didn't we? So thanks for your call. Maybe we can squeeze in one or two more. WBAI, you're on the air. No, you're not. Okay. WBAI, no? What's going on? WBAI, you're on the air. No? Okay, the number is 212-209-2900, and we're running out of time, but let's keep going. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Bill. Yeah, this is Bill from Queens. I think I'm on the air.
You are indeed.
Very good. Okay. I want to make a comment. The real problem is not immigration. It's the criminally low wages that farm workers and other jobs are paid. And nobody is talking about that. I don't even hear that being mentioned on WBAI.
That's a great point. I think it's also a lot of people in this country don't realize that farm workers have, that agricultural workers have fewer rights under labor law than other workers. I mean, they're really not only underpaid, but they actually have fewer rights under the law.
If they raised their wages, if there were a minimum wage law that took in these and other jobs, the immigration problem would certainly change, if not be totally solved.
Of course, there are minimum wage laws, which right here in New York and Queens, I live in Queens too, are being violated every day because the undocumented workers, because of the immigration laws, basically are very vulnerable and have trouble demanding their rights and demanding the minimum wage. So there is there's a connection with immigration, but the important thing to focus on is that the undocumented especially are being paid less than they should be paid and less than they would be paid if we didn't have this situation of having, you know, so-called illegal workers.
Okay, see if we can squeeze in one or two more calls. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello? WBAI, you're on the air. No? WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, great. Just a couple things, but today, in today's issue of Pueblo.es, there are two articles about, one is about xenophobia, the other one is about myths of immigration messing up social services in Spain, where I used to live. Apart from that, I wanted to ask about what kind of impact or what kind of future, immediate future, due to the projected economic situation in this country is going to look like next spring, and how this is going to affect actually a number of my friends who are undocumented.
Well, I mean, I think one thing that's going to happen is, of course, if there's a shortage of jobs, that's going to affect undocumented workers, but it's going to affect them in another way, because when there's an economic crisis, there is a tendency to scapegoat people in the minority. And I think we're going to see a rise in that if you know, as the economy gets worse, sure, as a way of distracting people from the real issues and the people who really cause the economic problems.
Which doesn't mean that it's inevitable. I mean, I think if people, can really get involved in trying to address this climate of xenophobia, then we can make a dent in it.
Which is what your book is all about. And you've got a website that exists to promote the book and your work and your dialogues. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, it's thepoliticsofimmigration.org. And that has a link to a blog where we also post additional articles, additional source materials, and announcements of upcoming events.
And we have lists of we're not just promoting our book. There are actually a number of good books out there. We have information on those books. There's a number of really good films that have been made. It's not that there aren't materials out there telling you what's really going on and giving you the straight story on immigration. It's that it's not getting out to people. And I think, you know, it's true. By the spring, if everybody was getting this material and reading it and learning it, then I think the situation would turn around very quickly. The anti-immigrant situation has been known to turn around in this country before.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, it certainly goes in cycles.
Yeah.
Should we, we've got 3 minutes left. Should we attempt to take one more call?
Sure.
Sure. WBAI, you're on the air. No, you're not. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Turn down the radio, please. Turn down the radio.
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Yeah, enjoying your show.
Good.
Very, very much. I congratulate the authors of that book.
Thank you.
I live in Newark, and I'm a community activist, and we have an awful problem here of unemployment among African Americans, young, especially young black men. You know, it seems that the prison industrial complex is locking all the young black men up that are unemployed and can't find work. In construction, Newark has a law that any construction and development, they have to hire 40% Newark residents. Hmm. But they refuse to do that. And the immigrant, and we're not against immigrants, they got all the construction work in the small houses, building the small homes, one, two family houses that have proliferated. This, you know, they got a building boom. all of that work went all to immigrants, and the African-American residents didn't get any of that. In defiance of the law that states clearly they have to hire 40% Newark residents, which should include some of African-Americans.
Absolutely.
You know, they got all, so Denverians got all of it. And most of the, and even the federal government, the HUD, H-U-D, there's a law that the Newark Housing Authority must hire 30% of Newark Housing Authority tenants in any construction and development involving the Newark Housing Authority. They got none of it. The Newark Housing Authority tenants got none of that. Even when they had a person of color in charge in the affirmative action in the Newark Housing Authority. It is just totally, so I don't know what to do. I just petitioned the city council, the county of Essex, which their own study found out, and they have a law that
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.